It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. History Camp is a gathering of people who love history. It's kind of like a conference, but presenters don't have to be professional historians. The presenters are people who love history, and they can create a proposal to share information on a subject they've taken a deep dive into. The people who attend are there just because they're curious and want to learn. The idea originated in Cambridge, Massachusetts back in 2013 and has been spreading around the country. Today, we'll get a preview of the fourth annual Iowa History Camp happening on Saturday, February 22nd at Drake University. You can find out more about it at historycamp.org/Iowa. Later this hour, we'll learn about two lost flyboys of World War II. We'll learn about the details of a New Deal project in Granger, Iowa that helped coal mining families survive and thrive, and also the striking of the Golden Spike, how the Transcontinental Railroad transformed the country. But first, Jennifer Mack is here. She is a bioarchaeologist with the Office of the State Archaeologist in Iowa City. She's also co-author of Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th century burial ground in a 21st century city. And it is that cemetery that she'll be talking about at History Camp. Her presentation is called Tomfoolery and Tuberculosis, Adolescent Health, Mortality, and Mortuary Treatment at Dubuque's 3rd Street Cemetery. Jennifer, hello.
Hello.
Well, we talked, actually, when your book came out, we talked a little bit about this cemetery on the show, but that was a long time ago. So let's get a refresher on this cemetery. We know that people were buried there from about 1833 to 1880?
Yep.
All right. And then why did you get involved? What happened that caused the archaeologists to head out to the 3rd Street Cemetery?
Sort of a series of events happened. The cemetery was filled up and closed about 1880. It fell into disrepair, was sort of vandalized in some cases. In any case, by the mid-20th century, there were no longer any above-ground indications that there even was a cemetery there, except for just a handful of stones. All the locals had come to believe that most of the graves had been moved at the turn of the century, so they cleaned up the property, they moved the few graves that were associated with the stones, and then they sold it for the Dominican sisters built a villa there, sort of a nursing home for nuns, but they didn't build directly on the old cemetery property, they built to the south of it. And that's how things stood until the early 2000s, when the villa closed and a new land developer purchased the property, and he wanted to put up these beautiful condos. And as soon as the bulldozers started, bam, there were bones.
Oh, so they started running into unmarked graves.
Yes.
A lot of unmarked graves. Tell me how many.
Well, yes. We went out there. Originally, the agreement with the land developer was that we would excavate the few graves that were left behind from this move at the turn of the century. And 4 excavation seasons later, we had excavated 939 graves.
Wow.
Which is a whole lot in a cemetery that was supposed to be empty or mostly empty.
Right. So the graves that people thought were moved were never moved.
There were not. There were 76 graves that we excavated were empty and had evidence that they had been previously removed. So that was, what does that work out to? Now I've forgotten. About 7 or 8% of the graves actually were probably moved by family members at the turn of the century. But there was never a large grave removal project, as people seem to think there had been.
Right. Well, and I can imagine that graves that were created during this time period from 1833 to 1880 were probably, many of them weren't marked in any kind of permanent way.
True. A lot probably weren't marked. A lot were probably marked with wooden crosses. But it is a little mysterious. There were a lot of prominent citizens that were buried in the cemetery who, we have no evidence that their graves were ever moved, and they would have had nice marble grave markers, and we don't know what happened to those.
So there's a great deal more to this story that we will probably never know.
Yes, it's not that uncommon for people to take grave markers out of abandoned cemeteries to use them in construction projects, so I suspect that that happened a little bit at Third Street.
All right. Now, you are focusing this presentation on the adolescents that were buried in this cemetery. And this is a fairly small number. Tell me how many adolescents you encountered as you started excavating these graves.
Out of the 939 graves, there were only 883 that were well preserved enough for us to determine age. And out of those, only 43 were adolescents. Osteologically, adolescence is defined as between 12 and 20 years old. So that's the age range that we were looking at.
And what makes these graves unique? I mean, obviously, they were young people. But what was it that really captured your attention about them?
I guess there were three things that I was interested in, even when we were in the field back in 2010. For one thing, just the number of them. It's sort of a truism in osteology that you don't find very many teenagers, because the dangerous time in life is when you're an infant, and if you survive that, you're likely to survive all the way to adulthood. My project, by the way, is finding that that's not really true. But yeah, the number that we had was interesting. And then there was, when we were in the lab and thinking back, I realized that all of the really memorable graves with unusual artifacts or very fancy coffin handles and fancy clothing, that all of these were the adolescent graves. Hmm. And I was interested in finding out why this might be a trend. And then the third thing that I noticed is that we didn't have evidence of perimortem trauma in any of the adolescent skeletons.
What does that mean?
Oh, sorry. Trauma from relating to the time of death. So people who die in violence or accidents, which is very common. Adolescents in modern America die from these external causes at a much higher rate than any other age group. And one could expect that that would be true, at least to some extent, in the 19th century.
Right, but because adolescents tend to take more risks, more physical risks.
Okay. Hence the tomfoolery title. But yeah, there was no evidence of this at all in the 43 Third Street skeletons.
Now, you mentioned unusual artifacts. Give me some details on that.
We had one teenage boy who had coins on his eyes. He was the only person who had coins on their eyes. From watching TV, you might get the impression that was really common in the 19th century, but it was not, apparently. There was a young woman who was buried with scissors, or almost like dress shears, you know, like cloth.
She loved to sew, maybe, or something like
that. Right, maybe. She definitely wasn't a seamstress by trade, because she had a very expensive coffin. And let's see, and another girl, the only person who was buried with a photograph, it was, you know, the glass amber type photograph, was in the grave with a teenage girl. So, and these, you know, it was a Catholic cemetery, so the church strongly advises against the inclusion of worldly goods in the grave. If you've got anything in your coffin with you, it's going to be a rosary or a religious medal or something. But an exception was made for these teenagers, and I was interested in finding out why.
Why do you think that is? I'm sure you have many theories.
I have a few theories, and a lot of it relates to something that's was going on in American popular culture from the mid-19th century on that was really separate from Catholic belief, but it was just so pervasive that, you know, we're all Americans, so we all have the same influences. And there was an increasingly domesticated vision of heaven appearing in the consolation literature and other forms of publications. Basically, some of it is really strange if you read it, that when you die, you just go on and your life in heaven is just a continuation of the life you had on earth, just much nicer. Mm-hmm. And I think it was this vision maybe that some parents were clinging to, the idea that the child that you brought almost to adulthood, you haven't failed. The kid is going to continue on in heaven and needs things with them.
All right. So send her favorite pair of sewing scissors and the photograph of a loved one.
Because they were also more likely to be buried in their Sunday best clothing instead of like a burial gown. So they're dressed up to continue life in heaven.
Interesting. Now, so you mentioned that you didn't see a lot of trauma in these teenagers. So what killed them?
Well, so I've been doing complementary research with death records from Dubuque, not from this cemetery, but from the non-denominational cemetery. We have some very extensive records. And the number one cause of death, of course, for everyone in America at the time was tuberculosis. But also the external causes, accidents, homicide, suicide, were the second most frequent cause of death for adolescents. And the most common external cause was drowning. A lot of teenagers drowned in Dubuque. And of course, that doesn't leave any evidence on the bones, even though it is an accidental cause of death. So I think that's probably a lot of the issue, is they were still dying from accidents, but we don't have any bony evidence. And reading in the newspapers about some of these deaths that I could find more details for, it wasn't that they were working on boats and drowned, or, you know, logging and drowned. They were, you know, one group of kids stole a boat with a hole in it and went out to the middle of the Mississippi, and that didn't end well. And then other kids were challenging each other to swim and in dangerous places. And
fascinating.
It was tomfoolery, and unfortunately, you know, it was their cause of death.
What do you want people who come to your presentation to take away from learning about this?
That's a tricky question. Well, I hope they'll just find it interesting. And I guess the main takeaway for me from doing this project is how much you need complementary sources, because the bones just don't tell the whole story based on the bone. Because tuberculosis, by the way, only affects the skeleton in between 3% and 5% of modern clinical patients. So even if half the people died in the cemetery died of tuberculosis, there would be very little bony evidence.
So it only tells just a part of the story.
Yes, it only tells part of the story.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me, Jennifer.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Mack is a bioarchaeologist with the Office of the State Archaeologist in Iowa City. She's also co-author of Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. And she's giving a presentation at History Camp. It's called Tomfoolery and Tuberculosis, Adolescent Health, Mortality, and Mortuary Treatment at Dubuque's 3rd Street Cemetery. History Camp, Iowa History Camp, is coming up Saturday, February 22nd at Drake University. And you can find out more at historycamp.org/Iowa. More to come. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of the 4th annual Iowa History Camp. It's coming up Saturday, February 22nd at Drake University. You can find out more about it at historycamp.org/Iowa. Coming up in a little while, we'll talk about the striking of the Golden Spike, how the Transcontinental Railroad transformed the United States. We'll also learn about two lost flyboys of World War II who came from Iowa. And my next guest is Darcy Malsby. She is a fifth-generation farmer in Lake City, Iowa, and an author. She has a book coming out in April called Iowa Agriculture, A History of Farming, Family, and Food. Her presentation at History Camp is called The Power of One, Lost Stories of the Granger Homesteads. And she's on the line with me now. Hello, Darcy.
Oh.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. And Darcy, the Granger Homesteads, this is about a New Deal project that took place in the Granger area in Dallas County. This was in coal mining country. So tell me a little bit about what was going on in the area during the Great Depression.
Yeah, and the story actually starts before the Great Depression, because a lot of folks don't realize that coal mining at one point was actually Iowa's number two industry, right behind agriculture. And places like Dallas County, which is just to the west of Polk County and Des Moines, that was a very coal-rich area. And so you had all these mines opening up from Waukee to Granger that were pumping out coal at an amazing rate. And living in a coal camp in Iowa back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was far from glamorous. These were pretty tough living conditions. The folks were living in shacks, literally, dirt streets, no running water. You might have a communal pump in the middle of one of these coal mining communities, but it was not a good place to live, especially if you were a child.
High infant mortality and mortality of young people, plus a black lung disease for many of the miners. This was a really difficult way of life. So, of course, the Great Depression made all of that worse, right?
Well, it did. It was one of those things, yeah, you're in a bad situation and life gets much worse, although I'm not sure actually with some of those coal mining families that it could have gotten a whole lot worse. But there was someone in Granger that took note and said, this cannot be. How can we have people living like this and barely able to feed themselves in some cases when we live in the middle of this rich agricultural region? And that man was Father Legutti. He was the parish priest in Granger. He had come there in 1926. He himself was an Italian immigrant. He was a farm boy at heart. That's how he grew up in Italy. And he kept looking at the natural resources in the Granger area. And one day, this all came together because he took his hunting dog out to hunt, and they were in a gully, and he was looking at the terrible soil erosion in the area, and he said, my goodness, if we can do something to take better care of this land, all wealth comes from the land. We need to find a way to help these folks, especially these coal miners, be able to tap into the riches of this land around here and help them get a better chance at life.
So he wanted to do something. Of course, we know that the New Deal was investing in people all over the United States. Tell me about the whole concept behind the Granger homesteads.
Yeah, it was a really interesting part of what was called the National Industrial Recovery Act. So that came, Congress passed that law in June of 1933, and there was a section of that that called for government financing of these things called subsistence homesteads. And Father Legutti gets wind of this and says, bingo, that is what we need if we could help people. It's kind of like an Iowa version, I guess, of 40 acres and a mule. If we could help people have their own nice little modern house and maybe a few acres of land, they could have better living conditions, they could raise more of their own food and become more self-sustaining. And so he takes advantage of this opportunity to apply to be a subsistence homestead in Granger. But it didn't go quite as smoothly as he'd hoped. In the fall of 33, he sends his first application to Washington. It was 4 pages. It promptly gets rejected. He's a bulldog, though, and he is not going to give up. So he sends 2 more applications. The next one was 12 pages. The last one was 68 pages. But finally, he gets approval from the federal government in 1934 to move ahead with the Granger homesteads.
And the Granger homesteads were small, I mean, only 4 acres. But the idea was that if you had that kind of land, you could grow enough food to support your family?
Exactly. So the plan called for 50 modern homes on this plot of land that was just kind of to the west of Granger. And the houses weren't that big. They were about 1,200 square feet. Some were 4 rooms, some were 5, some were 6. And each home came with a small acreage, usually somewhere between 2 to 8 acres. And it all depended on how large your family was. But boy, those folks, when they moved in, they started planting orchards, they started planting gardens, and they did become self-sufficient in that respect.
And the idea was that they would move onto this land and then, through a payment program, pay for the house over time?
That's exactly right. I like to say this was a hand up, not a hand out. So they were essentially getting a mortgage, but first they had to qualify by being a low-income family. At that time, that meant that they had to earn at least $600 and not more than $1,000 a year, which equates to about $11,000 to almost $19,000 in today's dollars. But yes, they had to get a mortgage from the government, and these were 30-year terms at 3% interest. So a lot of these families were paying just under $15 a month for their home and their acreage. And the whole project cost the U.S. government roughly in today's dollars about $3.3 million. And the beauty of this story is that all these families, they came through. They fulfilled their end of the bargain. They did not default.
So what do you think the legacy is of these Granger homesteads? Because I am sure that many people have been through this area many times over the years and have no idea what the story is behind these houses. What do you think the legacy is?
to me, the legacy is the power of one, because we had this one man, Father Luigi Lugudi, that saw a need, and he said, I can do something about this. And then you have this remarkable private-public partnership that was made possible through the New Deal, and it was this tremendous success story. Eleanor Roosevelt even came to Iowa in the 30s to see this for herself, because it was making national headlines. And the beauty of this story is a lot of those homes that were built in 1935, they're still there. They are still hot commodities when they come up on the market, because in the Des Moines metro, you can imagine a nice home with a decent plot of land, a beautiful acreage like that can be hard to come by. And the people of Granger are so proud. I've even met a gentleman who actually his family moved out there in 1935. And he said it was like moving from hell to heaven. So the power of one is such a powerful story here.
Well, he actually also thought that perhaps this saved lives in his family, right?
Absolutely. He said those mining camps, when we say they are tough, I think it's hard for a modern mind to even wrap our thoughts around how tough it was. I mean, rats running around and no insulation on these cold winter days. So, yes, truly moving from hell to heaven.
Wow. Well, Darcy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you so much.
Darcy Malsby, she is a fifth-generation farmer in Lake City, Iowa. She is also an author. She has a book coming out in April called Iowa Agriculture, A History of Farming, Family, and Food. And she'll be giving a presentation at History Camp called The Power of One, Lost Stories of the Granger Homesteads. And next up is Phil Berleski. He is a railroad historian and a retired Lutheran pastor from Vinton, Iowa. His History Camp presentation is Connecting America. And last year, we marked the 150th anniversary of the striking of the Golden Spike, which marked the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. Phil is with me now. Hello, Phil.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being back on the show. And all right, we spent a year celebrating the striking of the Golden Strike, or this Golden Spike. But still, for people who don't quite understand the significance of that, tell us a little bit about the Transcontinental Railroad and what that spike represented.
Okay. Well, before the railroad was built, and it was completed in 150 years ago, in 1869. There were three ways to get to California or the West Coast, California with all its wealth of gold and silver. The first way was to go cross country, walking or wagon train. And you had to leave early enough. The Donner Party left too late, and they suffered the consequences. Second way was to get on a boat somewhere, go to the Atlantic side of the Isthmus of Panama, get off the boat and slog through the jungle, malaria, yellow fever. If you survived that, you got to the Pacific Ocean, and you hoped that a ship would pick you up and take you to California. The third way was to get on a boat and sail all around South America, back up to California. All three of these routes were dangerous. A lot of people didn't survive. They took a long time, 6 to 9 months, to get to California. So here are three states, California, Nevada, and Utah, separated from the rest of the country by months and months and months. Not a very good way to run a country. Well, there have been proposals starting maybe 10, 15 years before to build some kind of a railroad across the country, but financing was impossible and so on. Abraham Lincoln, before he became president, made a campaign trip across Missouri and went up the river to Council Bluffs to give a campaign speech. And while he was there, he stayed at a rooming house hotel. And Lincoln had a big interest in railroads. He had been an attorney for two different railroads in Illinois. He defended the railroad bridge case at Davenport, Rock Island, when a ship crashed into the bridge and the boat company sued the railroad and so on. Lincoln had a big interest in railroads and thought that maybe building a railroad across the country would be the way to connect California with the rest of the nation. He was sitting on the porch, and someone said, "You got to talk to the guy next to you. That's Grenville Dodge. He knows railroading." So Lincoln pulled his chair over and had a conversation with Grenville Dodge, a civil engineer, And he asked Dodge, if we were to build a railroad across the country, where would it start and where would it go? And Dodge said it would start right here in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and you'd follow the Platte River west across Nebraska and Wyoming and west, and build another railroad from California east. When Lincoln became president in president in 1862, he signed the Pacific Railroad Act, which put the government in the business of subsidizing the building of a railroad across the country. Real construction didn't start until the end of the Civil War, 1865, and they completed it in 4 years, over 2,000 miles across the country, building west from Omaha, Council Bluffs, and east from Sacramento, California.
And I think that that's always so amazing to think about, that they built them to come together, and the incredible amount of work, engineering, and surveying that had to be done to make sure that they were actually going to meet.
Absolutely. And especially building from California, it meant going across the Sierra Nevada Mountains. A lot of people said, you'll never be able to build a railroad there, and if you do, it's going to be buried under snow 6 months of the year. But there was another remarkable civil engineer, Theodore Judah, a Californian, who found the route, and then railroad was built along his route. They built a lot of snow sheds and a lot of tunnels in order to make it happen. But, yeah, they came together on May 10th, 1869, at a nowhere place called Promontory Summit, Utah, northwest of Ogden, and had a big, big ceremony. It actually was a national holiday, and it spread to London and Paris and so on. It was a world-changing event, because what happened was you could now get on a train in Omaha, Council Bluffs, and you could be in Sacramento in 1 week, safe, sound, and economically, anywhere in the United States, and be in California in 2 weeks.
So it really made the United States a nation.
It really did.
So last year was the sesquicentennial, the celebration of the striking of the Golden Spike, and you got to be involved with that. You were actually invited to be a volunteer conductor with Union Pacific. Tell me about that.
There were 10 of us that part of a organization that's really centered in Omaha, who were asked to be volunteer conductors, and I started out with a train actually before the Golden Spike ceremony. I was in California in Sacramento just before Easter through about the end of May, including the big celebration at Ogden, Utah, and then I was a conductor again when the train was in Des Moines, Iowa on August 1st, and then finished out with them from Little Rock to Kansas City just before Thanksgiving.
Wow. What was that like for you? Because you've been excited about railroad history for a very long time.
Yes. Yes. It was fun. Most of the time we actually weren't riding on the train. We were set up for a display. For example, in Des Moines, there were thousands of people. I think there were 4,500 people who toured the train, and maybe another 5,000 who just came to see the train. One of the highlights of this, the train that toured the country was the rebuilding of the world's largest steam locomotive, one of the 25 big boys. There are 8 of them that have been preserved at different parks and museums. One of them was rebuilt by Union Pacific, and it toured the country last year and will again somewhere this year. We don't know where yet, but it's a locomotive that hasn't turned a wheel in over 50 years.
Wow.
It was built in 1941. And here it is, for example, parked in Des Moines, Iowa, where it never ran in its history. But, a live steam locomotive that thousands could enjoy.
So, Phil, before we have to let you go, you have presented at History Camp before, and
yes.
I've described what this is, this gathering of history buffs, some professionals, some not professional historians, just enthusiasts. What is it that keeps you coming back? What do you love about History Camp?
Well, I love history of all kinds. The presentation that we just heard about the farming and homesteading at Granger and so on. What a great story. And all the stories that are presented, a great variety of things. I enjoy learning things that I don't know anything about, just simply because I think I have a curiosity for history and so on. And I think that's why a lot of people come. Some people are experts in certain areas and want to hear more about things they know well. And then some of us also want to learn from people who have exciting topics that we're learning something new. And these are people that have invested a lot of their time and energy and that sort of thing in telling the story and uncovering history and facts and photographs and so on.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, and have a great time at History Camp.
We will. Thank you very much.
Phil Borleski is a railroad historian and a retired Lutheran pastor in Vinton, Iowa. His presentation is Connecting America, about the Transcontinental Railroad. Coming up, Lost Flyboys from Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. History Camp 2020 is coming up on Saturday, February 22nd at Drake University in Des Moines. This is the fourth year for Iowa History Camp, a gathering of history lovers from all walks of life who come together to learn about history and share their expertise. This hour, we're previewing some of this year's presentations, and my next guest is Matthew Walsh. Now, you don't have to be a professional historian to present at History Camp, but Walsh is one. He's a professor of history at DMAC's Urban Campus in Des Moines, and his presentation is called The Lost Flyboys. He'll share the experiences of two World War II airmen, Marvin Dilley, a bombardier from Belle Plaine, and William Meehan, a navigator from Des Moines. Hello, Matthew.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today. And there were many airmen from Iowa who participated in World War II. How did these two men grab your attention?
This story kind of starts at the Salisbury House. They had a history series there, and one of the speakers I remembered seeing on the History Channel back when the History Channel was about history and not Bigfoot building the pyramids. And he was talking about his uncle, who was an airman in World War II, and I just got really interested. I purchased the book and read it and was talking about it with my coworker, who I share an office with at DMAC. And she goes on to inform me that her father was a navigator in a B-17 during World War II, was shot down over Nazi Germany, and kept a sketchbook of his experiences. And I told her, wow, I would really like to get my hands on that sketchbook. And that was William Meehan. So researching Meehan led me to Marvin Dilley's story. So that's kind of how this all got started.
Yeah, well, and for people who aren't familiar with the airmen of World War II, and this was such an incredibly, of course, all lines of work in World War II were dangerous, but this was an incredibly dangerous line of work. Can you give me an idea of what the environment was like for these men?
People might not realize this, and it was something that I learned, but 26,000 plus airmen died during the Second World War, and that is more than all the Marines who died serving in World War II. And people just might not put that together. It was very, very dangerous. Just flying in these aircraft could be dangerous. In Iowa alone, there are over 400 military aircraft crashes that took place on Iowa soil. Part of that is because we have such large airspace, and also there's training centers for the Army Air Corps in Sioux City, where actor Jimmy Stewart famously served. And there's also a naval air station in Ottumwa, Iowa. 200 servicemen will die in these aircraft crashes on Iowa soil. Over 400 of the aircraft actually went down. Being in these airplanes, the casualty rates were ridiculously high. When Marvin Dilley and William Meehan are flying, only one in three airmen will complete their tour of duty. The tour of duty was 25 missions to get through, and each one is incredibly dangerous.
Wow. And how did they become airmen? Was this something that they would have gravitated toward themselves, or was this something they were assigned?
It's something that you gravitate towards. They see posters talking about the B-17, this cutting-edge, beautiful aircraft. It's got four engines, and just a very beautiful aesthetic, and it gets them excited because aviation, it is fairly new. It is very exciting, and they're told, hey, join the Air Corps. Women will fawn over you. Hey, join the Air Corps. You're not going to want to be stuck in a submarine or penned up in a ship. You can be above that all in an aircraft. And do you really want to be boots on the ground in the infantry? No, join the Air Corps. You'll go home to a nice base. The pay is great. And they just get really, really excited about this, and they join up. And, of course, they don't understand the casualties that we were talking about earlier, that 26,000 plus will die and 1 in 3 will complete their missions during the time that they serve. This is such deadly work that the Germans nicknamed these bombers flying coffins. Mm.
Let's get to know these two men. Tell me about Marvin Dilley before he went to war.
Yeah, I was fortunate to meet his niece, Elizabeth Rohr, and she sent me over his journals. He was a student at Belle Plaine High School. Probably the best thing you could say about him to summarize him is he's an outdoorsman. He loved being outdoors, hunting, fishing, looking at plants, hiking, you name it. He was also on the football team, ran track and field, participated in theater, but he really struggled to find employment. You get that struggle in his journal. He's bouncing around, trying to work in a packing plant in Waterloo, trying to work on the railroad, working on the Lincoln Highway on a service station in Belle Plaine. And he goes out to California and serves in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And it's really not until he joins the Army Air Corps that he gets a really good career. And he writes home, I sure do get a kick out of flying. As long as I'm up in the air, I'm happy. I wouldn't trade my job for anything. I like it, and I intend to keep it as long as I can. Gives him a real sense of self-esteem. So that's kind of his story.
Well, and let's talk about his experiences in combat. You mentioned those 25 missions that make up a tour of duty. And there is sort of a lore among the airmen that the first five and the last five are the hardest. What do we know about how his career started?
Yeah, his career gets going. And again, the conditions are very hazardous. When you go up over 10,000 feet in altitude, you have to go on oxygen. These airplanes are not insulated. They don't have the ability to just sit back and breathe. They have to be wearing oxygen masks at all times when they're over 10,000 feet altitude. And if that oxygen mask malfunctions, what happens is sometimes the breathing will cause the tube to freeze up. And this causes anoxia, which is going to lead to exhaustion and then blackout, and it can lead to death within a matter of minutes. And then up in the air, we're talking about a ceiling that these B-17 aircrafts have, you know, the height of Everest. That's how high they can fly. And it gets really cold up there when you're flying 200, 300 miles per hour. A mission that Dilley's bomb group was on was recorded to be minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit. It was freezing cold. So these guys had to wear flight suits that were electrically heated. And it's kind of like the old Christmas trees, if you remember the bulbs on those. We had one bulb go out, the whole line would go out. Mm-hmm. Well, in those early electric circuitry there for their flight jackets and everything else, if one thing went out, the whole suit went out, and you could face frostbite. If your hands touched bare metal, they would freeze to the bare metal, and your skin would rip off. But, yeah, he's serving, and on his fifth mission, he's flying, and he's actually going to go through flak. The United States Army Air Corps policy was to huddle the bombers together because there was safety in numbers. There was safety with the herd, and they would fly over a target in broad daylight, and then they would drop all of those bombs down. having those aircraft clustered together is also helpful for hopefully hitting the target. And the Germans know this, so they have something called flak. And what this is basically shrapnel. They shoot up artillery in the air, and this shrapnel explodes, and it rips through the airplane. Dilly and these other folks, they have no choice but to go through this flak. And on this occasion, flying above France on his fifth mission, things don't go so well. And this is a quote from the service paper, Stars and Stripes. It says, "Flak sent up by the defenders of Lille Nord, France, pierced the fortress, full boost, ripped the May West, worn by Second Lieutenant Marvin E. Dilly, a bombardier of Belle Plaine, Iowa, bent Dilly's parachute clasp, went through his flying suit, and cut his dog chain in two." Mm. So Marvin, he suffers injuries to his rib, to his head, and he actually has to have surgery, but he does heal up, and he writes home, probably shaken from what he experiences, but he leaves out his brush with death.
He writes some very comforting letters home from from this life. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other man that you profile, William Meehan. He's a navigator from Des Moines. Tell me about him before he went to war.
Yeah, in the Army Air Corps Academy photo book, they talk about how a navigator has to have a lot of gray matter between the ears. They're kind of seen as the brains of the operation. And William Meehan is a very bright fellow. He attends Roosevelt High School. He makes the honor roll every year he's there. He also excels in sports, although his football team is very, very crummy. He does start in letters and football, and he's also on the rowing team. His family was from the Des Moines area. They ran a deli in Valley Junction, and he's going to get called to war and becomes a navigator. And as I said, you have to have a lot of brains for this, a lot of math. They're learning meteorology. You arrive at the exact point at the exact time you're supposed to. That's called 00, and that's what he would strive for.
And these two men did not serve together. They didn't work together. You're profiling two different airmen from Iowa. And Marvin Dilly, we talked about his missions and again, 25 missions in a tour of duty. With William Meehan, how far did he get through that tour of duty?
Yeah, at the time that he flew, the life expectancy of a bomber crew during Meehan's time was about 15 missions, and he did not get anywhere near 15. On one of his early missions, about mission number 4 or 5, he's participating in something called Big Week, and Big Week is when the Army Air Corps really unloads on Germany. They launch 6,000 plus raids, bombing targets of strategic importance. And Meehan's flying, and on February 20th, he gets separated from the pack, him and his airplane, and it's called the Joker. And what happens is fighters come and they attack and they shoot up his airplane. And then that flak that we talked about earlier explodes, and it knocks out the engines, number 1 and 2, to his airplane. And he has to try to get the heck out of there. And it's really hard to do that, because when these planes, they lost control, airmen would be pinned to the plane. They wouldn't be able to move. So if it's in a dive, you can't get out. And if it's a dive or in a tailspin, that force is throwing you side to side as well. So you want to try to level out the airplane. And people in his unit, they talked about his plane going down, and he became missing in action. His parents, Ed and Ruth, receive a telegram saying, "Hey, sorry to inform you, but your son was reported missing in action on February 20th. If we have any more information, we'll get back to you." And you can imagine just the sheer terror a parent would have opening that message.
And you mentioned earlier this coworker with the journal and sketchings from a relative that was in a German POW camp. That was William Meehan. So he survived that crash.
He does survive. The crash, it's going to happen. And he talks about bailing out. And here's a quote from him in that sketchbook we were talking about. He says, the most overpowering sensation is that feeling of being completely suspended in space. After the initial shock of the chute's opening, there is no apparent movement or feeling of descent. It is as if you were hung upon a hook at 1,000 miles above the earth. It takes 10 to 12 minutes to make the descent. You look about you, that flaming meteor below and to the right. Are the remains of your fortress disappearing into the cloud deck? One of your boys is still aboard that flaming coffin, killed at his gun post. You think about the telegrams going home. The folks will take it. You suddenly have a feeling of great loneliness. You are lost in the middle of enemy country.
You will be sharing his story with your audience, his time in the German POW camp, and he did make it home. But Marvin Dilley did not make it home. What happened to him?
No, he did not. It's quite tragic. Again, 25 missions. You have to get through this. It's so difficult. Each and every mission, you're fighting. And his crew, almost all these guys, were on their 25th and final mission. And shortly after takeoff, there was a malfunction in the engine. We don't know exactly what caused it. The engine catches fire on the left side. The left wing is ablaze, and the pilots are starting to wrestle the airplane. They can't control it, and it's about to go down. Well, what do we do? This plane is loaded with tons and tons of bombs. So the decision is made to drop the bombs and hope that maybe losing that weight will allow the plane to elevate. And when those bombs are dropped, the explosion and its force send this plane out of control even more so than it was prior, and it crashes in England. The plane never left England, and all crewmen are tragically killed on, as I said, their 25th and final mission.
Heartbreaking. Why do you think it's important to share these two men's stories?
Reading about Dilley, he was only mentioned in two little excerpts. They got his hometown wrong. They called it Belle Plains. And then in another excerpt, again, another two sentences on this guy is all I could dig up. They got his name wrong. They called him Marvin Dill. And I just thought, here we have this guy who's given his life for our country. I think we can do better and learn a little bit more about him. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to profile the sacrifice of these servicemen, and to, if they can go through all these terrible things, the least we can do is learn about their experiences and be inspired, because we face hurdles in our everyday lives, but certainly they're not like flying over Nazi Germany in a bomber.
Matthew Walsh, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Matthew Walsh is a professor of history at DMAC's Urban Campus in Des Moines. He'll be giving a presentation at History Camp 2020 called The Lost Flyboys. And if you'd like more information about Iowa History Camp 2020 coming up Saturday, February 22nd at Drake University, you can go to their website, historycamp.org/Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. You never need to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Please subscribe to our podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Talk of Iowa and drop us a line anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.